One good thing about the Washington bill is there's no cap. What some states are doing is their caps. And by the way, this is not a competition between states. I want every state to do well, because if we're going to get SAF to scale, then we're going to need everybody on board. But the Washington bill doesn't have a cap. It also increases based on the carbon intensity. So the better the fuel is for the life cycle of that fuel, when you look at the feedstock, the more credit you're going to get.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Andy Billig. Andy Billig is a senator with the Washington state, not Washington, D.C., the state of Washington in the U.S., where you have big cities like Seattle. But Andy is based in Spokane. Why do I have a government official on this podcast, which primarily has featured technology entrepreneurs as well as airline and aviation CEOs? Well, that's because Andy and his team are responsible in creating regulations that make Washington State very, very attractive to sustainable aviation fuel companies to come and make SAF there. I discuss with Andy what it takes to create a conducive environment to help sustainable aviation thrive. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Andy, when we met in Houston, I was amazed to learn that not only are you a significant figure in the Spokane community, but you have a children and education and working families portfolio. And yet here you are working on sustainable aviation. How does this all tie in together?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I really feel honored to be a guest with you and looking forward to our conversation. You know, when I think sort of broadly about what I'm trying to achieve as a legislator for my community in my state, it's about opportunity and prosperity. And environmental stewardship is such a big part of that. And that has been a big part of my legislative career as well. And sometimes local issues like protecting the Spokane River and also certainly fighting climate change and reducing carbon emissions. And Washington State is such a leader in fighting carbon emissions. So, you know, we've passed a 100% renewable electricity bill, a low carbon fuel standard bill, a cap and invest bill, all since I became the majority leader. So it's been a big focus. So the sustainable aviation fuel works really a natural extension of that. And then also sometimes there's serendipity, because 12 years ago as a freshman in the House of Representatives, I did a term in the House before I moved to the Senate, the chair of the Energy Committee, which I was on, just handed me a folder and said, "Billig, this is your bill." And it was a bill about sustainable aviation fuels, which I was so glad about, because it was such an interesting topic, really at that time, a new topic, and also blended with sort of an interest in aviation that I've always had.
When was this again, Andy?
This was in 2012.
This was over a decade ago, when yes. Not many people knew about sustainable aviation fuels. Did yes. you know anything about what you're getting into?
I really did not. And that's what was so great. And it's what's so interesting about serving in the legislature too, is you learn about all of these issues, but it really started a 12-year journey in education for me on sustainable aviation fuels.
Why you? Why did he hand this to you, not someone next to you in the legislature?
I don't know exactly. I would bet that it was an interesting but not an overly controversial bill. So a good bill for a freshman. And he knew I also had interest in economic development, which is certainly a part of the goal as well. I think that's why. And okay. So much about what we do, you know, we work on 10,000 different issues, but you can only be an expert in a few. And so sometimes it's personal interest or what your other job is because we're a citizen legislature, or sometimes it's because there's just a need for that person and everybody else had a full plate. And as a new member, I had a little bit of opportunity for something.
Okay, I'm going to start from the end then. Your recent bill, the Senate Bill 5447, was a landmark bill in Washington State because it offers tax incentives for manufacturing and purchasing alternative jet fuel. What was the motivation behind this legislation, and what do you expect to achieve out of this? And then we'll work backwards on how you got here.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, again, we've been working on sustainable aviation fuel in Washington State for a long time. And when you think about it, we have almost everything about sustainable aviation fuel right here in Washington State. So we're a leading aerospace state anchored by Boeing, really robust aerospace industry. We're a technology state. We have airlines that are interested, particularly Alaska with its base here. Also, Delta has a big hub here, is interested in SAF. We have airports that are interested. SeaTac and Spokane International Airport, both very interested and active on SAF. We have military air bases with naval air stations and Air Force bases, and the military is interested. We have almost all the feedstocks. We have something a lot of people don't know. We have the leading research, you know, maybe in the world at Washington State University, is one of the centers for excellence for sustainable aviation fuels, MIT and Washington State, right here in Washington State. So we have almost everything except for production. And production of SAF is where you start getting the economic benefits, so the investments and all the jobs. So it really made sense that if we wanted to sort of close the loop and do everything here, including the part that really drives the economic development, that we needed production here. And so that's how we got to working on this bill and to create an incentive to try to bring more production here.
Now, by the time the bill had passed, you weren't the first. California already had passed a similar bill. I believe New York, Illinois were also passing similar bills. In fact, California, if I'm not wrong, already had 80% of the global available supply of SAF, thanks to the bills that had been passed in the state. Is this what you were trying to achieve? How's yours different?
Well, each one is a little bit different. One good thing about the Washington bill is there's no cap. What some states are doing is they're caps. And by the way, this is not a competition between states. I want every state to do well, because if we're going to get SAF to scale, then we're going to need everybody on board. But the Washington bill doesn't have a cap. It also increases based on the carbon intensity. So the better the fuel is for the life cycle of that fuel, when you look at the feedstock, the more credit you're going to get. And that's something when we're talking to the airlines and the producers that really made a lot of sense. And there's another piece to this, because we knew that it's not just about the incentives. You also have to be able to build these facilities, and siting of facilities, production facilities, can be hard in any state, and in Washington State was the case. So we also passed another bill in tandem with this bill to streamline project siting for green energy projects. That wasn't specific to SAF, but SAF was certainly included. So I think that we have now the incentive and a little bit of easier path. I'm not really familiar with California permitting, but or other states, but definitely something here that you could realistically get something online in a reasonable amount of time.
So when you were coming up with this, did you consult airlines and SeaTac, your major airports? What was the composition? How did you get to the end result?
Yeah, so we can talk a little bit about the Washington State work group that we have, which we'll get to in a minute. But we already have this network of stakeholders. And so we tapped into that, this work group that we've had for really 12 years. And so we had a community and a network already established, but we had a lot of conversations with the producers and with the airlines. And we got, I think, a bill that will really work well for them. One of the things, for instance, they said is we want the credits to be flexible, not just for the producer, but the producer can take the credit, the blender, their designated blender can take the credit, or the airline can take the credit. And that gives you maximum flexibility to utilize it. So that's an example of feedback we heard from the producers and airlines that got into the final bill, and I think is why they got excited about it.
Okay, so you mentioned the working group already. You are the chair of the Sustainable Aviation Biofuels Work Group. What was the involvement and why did you decide to chair it? I'm sure you weren't asked, hey, Andy, go chair this group.
So the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Work Group for Washington State was created in that first bill, that bill that I talked about from 12 years ago. That was, it did a few things, but that was one of the things that the bill did. And I should have mentioned this earlier. One of the reasons we got to that bill and the reason we were working on this, I could see you were surprised that we were working on this in 2012. In 2011, there was something called SAFIN, the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Northwest Assessment. It was the first regional assessment of its kind in the nation. And this is, again, Boeing and Alaska and the airports and WSU environmental groups. Everybody got together and did an assessment saying, hey, is Washington State, is the Northwest, the right place to advance SAF technology and production? And, you know, the answer was a resounding yes. And out of that group, one of the recommendations was we need the legislature to be involved in this. And so the work group's goal is to provide a connection for all of the diverse stakeholders in what's still a young industry, but was really a young industry at that time. But also that group helps to educate the legislature. So we do reports to the legislature and so that group has really been vital, not only for my education, but I think for advancing this industry and sort of keeping it at the forefront of people's minds.
Very interesting. So going back in 2012, you were asked to lead this, which led to the working group, which then ultimately led to the bill that was passed. You're the first guest I'm having on the podcast who's not from an airline or from a technology company or who's not an activist, for example. You're from the government. Why does the government take so long to pass these bills?
Yes. It's such a good question. And this goes into a little bit of sort of political theory. But, you know, when I first got to the legislature, even before I was in the legislature, and again, I don't have a political background or government background. I'm the CEO of a company that owns and operates minor league sports teams. So I didn't really have this big background in government. So when I got to the legislature, I was like, oh my God, it takes so long to do anything. But what I realized was it's really on purpose. It's by design to take a long time because laws are so significant. A law can, you know, prevent you from doing something or require you to do something or make you pay a tax or, you know, that I think the philosophy of the founders of our state and our country was let's make it really hard. And, you know, if that means a bill or two dies that really should have passed, that's better than having a bill pass that shouldn't have passed. Now, that's not to say we don't pass bad bills because occasionally we do. But the other thing I'll say about the bill that we passed, 5447, the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Incentive Bill that we just passed this past session in 2023, that bill did pass in 1 year. So it actually was, you know, conceived and researched and written before the 23 legislative session, introduced for the 23 session and passed that same session. And that for a big bill is not always the case. As you mentioned, things can take longer, but if it's the right policy and there's a lot of support, things can move faster.
Okay, so 1 year is a short time in the government annals. So it's good to get some perspective here, when we are talking. You highlighted that the tax incentives that increase depending on the reduction in emissions. What feedback have you received based, from fuel producers and airlines regarding this structure?
Well, the feedback's been very positive because, one, because they've had a lot of input into the bill. So it really, I think they feel some ownership in the bill because, you know, we didn't take every recommendation, but we took a lot of them. And then I think the proof that it's making progress is that we have three companies already that are interested in Washington State. BP, Sky Energy has announced that they're looking at Washington, and then 12, which is a smaller company, but they've already broken ground on a sustainable aviation fuel production facility in Moses Lake, Washington. So I think, you know, the feedback that we're getting in words has been positive, but also in the actions that we're seeing from the production companies. And you and I were in Houston at the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Congress. And we, you know, there were numerous companies who approached me saying, hey, we're looking at Washington and started some conversations there as well.
Are you getting this kind of feedback from mostly US-based companies, or is this a global phenomenon? Someone like, like Neste coming and saying, oh, can we set up a factory in Washington State?
Yeah, definitely global. And that's, you know, Sky Energy being a Dutch right. company for one. So yeah, definitely global from other companies as well.
Okay. It's very interesting. What sort of, I mean, when a government is looking to pass a bill, what sort of economic benefits and job opportunities do you foresee arising from a bill like this?
Well, certainly the initial investment. So, you know, these facilities are $800 million, $1 billion of investment. So that's a lot of construction jobs, a lot of engineering jobs, which are going to be great for our communities. And then, you know, that money being spent in our communities is really positive. And then the ongoing jobs to operate it is really important. And a lot of this investment, not all of it, but, you know, I anticipate that these production facilities will mostly be in rural areas, which are more economically depressed. So that will help those areas as well. And then a little bit of a less direct benefit, but, you know, Washington is a leader in so many ways, whether it's aerospace or technology, and you sort of feed on it. So, you know, people say, well, Washington's a good place to go for technology companies because there are a lot of technology. So the more we can be a leader in things, mm-hmm. the more momentum I think you get, and you create other momentum. So, and other opportunities. So I think it just, there's wins on a lot of levels.
Okay. So this is like a flywheel concept. The more companies you attract, the more, you know, you help the ecosystem. Now, the question I have is, how does local production, as opposed to importing SAF, benefit you? Why not, you know, truck the SAF up from California, for example?
Yeah, I think that would be that is a path to using SAF, and not a terrible path. But by having the production here, we get that economic benefit from the jobs here and from the investment here. And, you know, I guess you could also look at that question from another, what about producing it here and then having it used somewhere else? Because it's not certain that it would be used here just because you make it here. But we also really, you know, another benefit of sustainable aviation fuel is that the particulate matter in the fuel is less. Generally, it depends which jet fuel you're comparing it to. But generally, the particulate matter is this. And that's something that was really appealing for communities near airports, particularly near SeaTac, and for airport workers.
Okay. I can definitely see the entire multiplier effect coming in here, right? The bill mandates also Washington State University and University of Washington to calculate emission benefits. How will this data be utilized by you and your team in shaping future sustainable aviation policies?
Well, this was kind of speaking of the clean air benefits, the cleaner air benefits around the airport. So there were a couple of legislators who represented areas around SeaTac. And so they were very interested in SAF for this reason about the lower particulate matter. And so they wanted to measure. And we try with our legislation to measure everything because we want to be data informed in the things that we do on behalf of the people of Washington State. So, you know, there's always support to measure things. Now, the thing about SAF, it's going to be a while before we're probably at the level where we're using enough of it that you really could measure the difference in air quality at a particular airport. You know, we're definitely, you know, years away from that. But the good thing about starting, I think it starts in 2024, we'll create a baseline and then we can measure against that baseline.
Okay. I have a few other questions around this. In Europe, especially, there is a lot of debate about where the SAF comes from. The feedstock is specifically what I'm referring to. Does the bill specify at all where the SAF comes from, or is there any preference given to new technologies like e-fuels?
Yeah, we tried to be completely technology neutral. So we didn't want to put our fingers on the scales or prevent something that you know hasn't even been invented yet. I was just talking with our Department of Ecology about carbon capture technology and getting credits under our cap and invest or our clean fuel standards for carbon capture if it's then used for sustainable aviation fuel. Well, when those bills were written, carbon capture wasn't done in a way that was economical. And now the point source carbon capture is actually a company in Spokane that's creating units to do point source carbon capture that we could be using that CO2 for SAF potentially. And so we're trying to do as much as possible to not preclude that development in the future. Now we're going to look at the carbon intensity so that you can't come up with some technology that's heavily carbon intensive somewhere in that feedstock cycle. That is important to look at. But in terms of what the current or future technologies are, we want to be neutral.
That is very interesting. Now, this also leads to the other aspect, which is if you are technology neutral, what about other sectors? Because you are looking at education, working families, you are responsible not just for aviation, but a lot of other sectors. What if the incentives for producing SAF in the state take resources away from other sectors that might need it, let's say biodiesel?
Well, again, I think the market will have a big impact on whether it be used for renewable diesel or it's used for SAF. And that's one of the challenges that SAF has had is that renewable diesel seems to have some additional incentives. So, you know, the incentives that we now have in Washington State maybe help to even that out. But we don't want to control everything. We do want the market to help to determine. We're giving a little help to a new industry, but the market will largely do that. Now, that's you're comparing it to renewable diesel. I think you could also ask the question is, and this is something maybe as environmental advocates and others are interested in, is what if that competes with food, the development of sustainable aviation fuels? Well, that's a problem. And that's, I think, one of the things to when you figure the life cycle impact of SAF, you really have to take that into account.
If you actually see shortages on the food side, do you have something in your kitty to deal with that?
Well, I don't think it would be considered sustainable aviation fuels if it's actually taking land out of food production land out of service. So and you know that this is one of the challenges. And when we were in Houston, there was a lot of talk about credits and separating the credit from the physical properties of the fuel. And then how are those credits sort of validated and book and claim? And, you know, how are we going to make sure that this industry is sort of legit in the eyes of the public and particularly the environmental community? And making sure we have a robust system to certify and track the feedstocks and making sure we're not doing that, I think is vital to the success of this industry and for us to help decarbonize the aviation sector.
Right. I like where you're going, being the incentive-led approach. I remember Sky Energy CEO was quoted in the Seattle Times saying that Washington State has the best incentives today to produce SAF in the U.S. What does this do to the price of SAF? Is it at par with Jet A today if it's produced in Washington State? What's the price premium?
We don't know the answer to that exactly because it, you know, there are so many factors. First of all, what's the price of Jet A that changes? also, what's the technology? What's the efficiency of and the feedstock and of the actual facility that's producing the SAF? And then also, what other credits are there? Because we're going to try to layer with federal incentives as well. So we don't know that it's equal, but we know that we're making it closer. And even, you know, I've listened to your podcasts and, you know, if you listen a couple of years ago, you talk about SAF being, you know, 3 to 5, 6 times more expensive. Well, you don't, you know, now you, what is it? You know, 1.5, 2, 3 times, you know, it's getting closer even without. So the idea is anything we can do to bring those levels between regular Jet A and SAF closer, that's going to drive more use, which is then going to do that momentum and create the incentive for more production. And it's once, and then more production means it's being done more efficiently, so the price can come down. So we've just got to start that cycle, and then I think it comes together. And look, the airlines really want this. They obviously aren't going to be able to pay a premium, or at least not, you know, all the time, and or most of the time they're not going to be able to pay a premium. I think they're doing it in some small cases. I think customers want it. And that's the other thing that's neat about Washington State. I mean, this happens all over the world, but we have a bunch of non-aviation companies that are interested in SAF. And you look at Amazon, which is based here, Microsoft, and many others. And so they're helping to drive this. And I think they will pay a little bit of premium to help close that gap. But we're not there yet. We got to keep working on it.
So let's address then what's known as book and claim. That is primarily for states or territories where there is not a continuous production of SAF. And currently, correct me if I'm wrong, Washington State does not have continuous production of SAF.
Correct.
Are you looking at book and claim? And is this something on your radar? And if so, how does it help?
Yeah, and I don't profess to be an expert in book and claim. I know just enough to know that I don't know enough. But I think book and claim is going to be important because, again, we need the market to help here. So it is possible that production starts here and that we'll need to sell, those companies will sell the SAF somewhere else or send it somewhere else. And so book and claim or used here, but from people that are purchasing essentially other places, but the physical molecules will be here, so it doesn't have to be shipped. There's so many variations on that. And book and claim is vital to making sure the market is actually helping to bring this all together. And if you don't have book and claim, then you're saying you've got to actually buy the molecules, buy the fuel, and then put that actual fuel into the plane that somebody's using. And that practically is just so hard. So I think book and claim is important, but book and claim is also important for the reason we said, because that helps with sort of the legitimacy of tracking. So if you're going to differentiate between the molecule and the credit, you really need a robust system for tracking that, making sure it's not double counted, and all of that stuff that we heard about in Houston and the people are working on, really smart people. I think that's one of the biggest challenges for SAF right now, is to get that right. And so it's something we're tracking, but, you know, obviously as a state government, that's not something we're going to be leading on.
Right. No, that's fair. And thank you for addressing that. While the US states have focused on incentives, the EU countries have focused on mandates. Do you foresee Washington State, or for that matter, any other US states, introducing some mandates to go along with these incentives as well?
It's interesting to think about how the EU and US are going about it differently and how that may impact. I mean, that interplay, because again, SAF can be used essentially anywhere, can physically be shipped or the credits can be done. So what happens in Europe is an impacts what's happening in the US. So we've been tracking Europe closely. I don't think you'll see states actually with mandates, because the federal government would prohibit us from doing it for any interstate flights. So you could only theoretically, I'm not even sure if you could do it, but you could theoretically do it for in-state flights. In Washington, we don't have that many in-state flights. Maybe California, and I had heard some talk that maybe they were looking at that. Maybe they have enough in-state flights that there would be enough volume to look at that, but I'm not even certain. I think that would be a complex question for the state federal interplay.
We'll see how this goes. Where do you see the future of sustainable aviation in Washington state and the U.S.? How do you see it evolving in the next decade or so?
Well, I hope it evolves robustly because we need it. Our planet needs it. And certainly we would like it to be here. So I hope that there's robust development here and in other states and other countries. But there's just so many factors from the technology, the investment, the feedstocks, the incentives, market forces, the book and claim, which we were just talking about. All of that, what's happening in Europe, federal policy, all of that will have an impact in what happens in Washington State. But all we can control is what we control, which is to provide the incentives we have to try to smooth the siting, which, and also I just wanted to mention on the siting, it's not like we're throwing siting and permitting out the window. We still are going to make sure that we're responsible on how we site things. We just want to make sure we do it in a streamline. But anyway, all of those many factors will determine the future of sustainable aviation in Washington State. But I think we've got a pretty good path here for success.
All right. You've, of course, been involved in so many different areas, from children to family. You have a sports management company you run. What was the most uniquely challenging aspect of getting this bill over the line?
Well, luckily, there was a lot of support for sustainable aviation fuel, for all of the things we've talked about, the economic benefits, air quality benefits, certainly the global climate benefits. So all of that made it a fairly easy path. I think education, though, was probably the biggest thing, that even though we've been helping to educate the legislature over the last 12 years or so from our work group, there's still, it's just not at the front of minds of most legislators or constituents. So we've just been trying to educate. And then one other little bit of a hurdle was just some confusion about SAF relative to electric aircraft or hydrogen powered aircraft, which also we have a lot of progress in Washington State on those fronts. And I think some people, some legislators viewed it as sort of an either or. Oh, is this, should I be in favor of SAF or should I be in favor of electric aircraft? And trying to help them educate, it's not either or, it's and both. There's different functions, you know, for different technologies and different timelines as well.
Right, right. This is
very. And I'll mention that you talk about challenges. We did pass it with almost unanimously. We had unanimous in one of our chambers and one no vote in the other. So we were able to get past most of the challenges.
Wow. So since the bill has passed, what have been some of the big highlights? I know Sky Energy has announced the establishment of their plant. What other big highlights have there been?
Yeah, BP announced that they are looking seriously and doing feasibility work on adding a SAF production facility at their current Cherry Point facility that makes Jet A. And then 12, which is a small company created by some Stanford faculty, has broken ground on a facility in Moses Lake. So that those are the headlines. But then with all of the other conversations sort of going on, and our Department of Commerce has been very active in talking to companies about looking at sites and helping to explain the incentives. But those have been the big highlights so far.
I'm glad to hear this. I think overall, this has been very encouraging. It's so good to get a behind the scenes view of what goes on. How does the government pass a bill and how what it takes to get this over the line? I'm really happy to see the momentum you're getting, and hopefully that will only go bigger here, and we'll see a significant supply of SAF in Washington State. Andy, what do you say to people who say that the bill doesn't go far enough in pushing for sustainable aviation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, I'll just say broadly, the environmental community in Washington is very supportive of SAF and worked to help pass the bill. They were part of the stakeholder group that worked on the bill before it was introduced. Their environmental groups are part of our sustainable aviation fuel work group. So broadly, the environmental community is supportive. But there were some parts of the environmental community that thought that the answer is to not fly, that that's how to decarbonize the aviation industry is to not fly. And we had some people show up at different hearings to make that case, to say this is just going to allow people to keep flying. And even if SAF works a little bit or a lot, it's not going to be enough to decarbonize the way we need to. And, you know, it not flying would reduce emissions, but I just don't think that's a realistic strategy. And certainly there would be other negative consequences. But again, that was a very small minority opinion. I think the other conflict is on the siting of the green energy facilities. And there's a guy named Ross McFarlane. He's on the National Sierra Club board, and he's been really active in Washington State, doing a lot of great work on SAF and other environmental issues. And he said in a meeting not too long ago, the environmental community is really good at stopping things, and for good reason. And really have stopped a lot of dirty, polluting things that would be in our state. But when we think about a transition to a green economy, and we're going to get all those environmental benefits, we also have to make sure that we're going to actually be able to site the things that are going to make that green economy possible. And so it's a little bit of a transition, I think, for the environmental community to say, yeah, it's a production facility or it's a transmission line. But we need that if we're going to fight climate change and if we're going to have the economic benefits as well as the environmental benefits of the green economy. And so that sort of conversation and work within the environmental community and with the environmental community, I think has been really important, and we see it happening, and I think it's really positive. So the last thing I'll just say about people who say, hey, it doesn't go far enough or have some environmental concerns is I think concerns that the life cycle of the feedstocks may not be robustly evaluated. And I think that's a legitimate concern. And I think it's something, as we talked about with book and claim and tracking credits and make sure they're not double counted. I think that's a real legitimate concern that the industry needs to account for, and to say SAF is the S in SAF is sustainable, and we're going to make sure that we deliver on that, and that it truly is sustainable. And there's a lot of good work going on in that area, which I'm glad to see, but we need to keep at that.
Fantastic. Thanks for silencing your critics here. The final part of this interview is what I call the rapid fire round, in which we, our listeners, in your case, your constituents, will get to know you a bit more personally. And they're simple questions. So I'll start with, for example, what's your favorite airline?
I have to go with my hometown airline, Alaska Air. But I also have a special place in my heart for the most obscure airline I've ever flown, which was Druk Air.
Druk Air in Bhutan.
Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay. I have not flown that one yet, but it's on my list. Yeah. I'll tell you something obscure about an obscure airline, Druk Air. They have recently announced launching a new flight from Singapore to Palau in the South Pacific. Go figure why a Bhutanese airline will be flying from Singapore to Palau.
Interesting.
Obscure becomes even more obscure. Yeah. So, what about your favorite book?
Well, to be a good guest, I should say Sustainability in the Air, your new book.
Thank you very much.
I haven't read it yet. I don't even know if you can buy it yet, but I will read it.
It is out on Amazon. So
it's yes. Not. Yeah. Okay, good. I know it just came out, so I'll look forward to reading it. But I love the book, The Right Stuff, which is about the Mercury 7 astronauts and Chuck Yeager, the early space
players. Okay. I'm going to check it out. The Right Stuff.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
Yeah, and it's a movie. There's a movie, The Right Stuff, too, which is wonderful.
Okay, I'm Googling it right now. Okay, I'm quite a space geek, and I would love to find out more. What's your favorite city?
Well, I have to say Spokane. Spokane is just one of the. I think it's a really underrated city. I'm so glad you had a chance to drive through not too long ago. But with the sort of majestic waterfalls in the middle of downtown is really unique. But I also love Washington, D.C., which is where I grew up and went to college.
Wow. You moved from Washington, D.C. to Washington State.
Yeah, Washington, Washington.
Interesting. What's your favorite movie?
And, you know, I think I'm taking these questions with a little bit of an aviation theme, but
no. I'll go What's with... the first one that comes to your mind?
Yeah. The first aviation movie that came to my mind was actually To Fly, which is an IMAX movie. That it was one of the first IMAX movies, certainly the first IMAX movie I ever saw. And they played at the Air and Space Museum, not long after the Air and Space Museum opened. And I grew up in D.C., so I remember seeing this incredible IMAX aviation movie, and it had such an impression on me. And I think it's part of, you know, fueled my interest in aviation.
Wow, this is very fascinating. I had no idea. A 1976 movie that opened at the Smithsonian, interestingly.
Yeah. So, the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. And
wow.
I think it was one of the first IMAX theaters, actually.
Wow, fantastic. I'm learning so much right now. You've even flown an airline. I have not flown. Now I'm really intrigued. What is something you want to learn, Andy?
I want to keep learning about other cultures. That's something I travel a lot, and I love that. So I hope to keep learning about other cultures.
Fantastic. What is something that you do in your free time?
I run and I ride my bike, and I used to do triathlons. But I would say it's, you know, spending time with my family or... I think the other thing is I go to a lot of baseball and hockey games because of my other job. I do that for work, but also for fun.
For pleasure. Right. What is the best advice you've received?
Oh. You know, I think one of my favorite pieces of advice is some leadership advice. And there's a famous baseball manager a long time ago named Casey Stengel. And he said, the key to good leadership is to keep the people that hate you away from the ones that are undecided. And I love that advice. But wow. Seriously, I think the best advice I ever got was don't accept the conventional wisdom. And in our company and my legislative work, I've really sort of adapted that. We might do something the way it's been done before, but we'll never do something because that's the way it's been done before.
Very nice.
Try to keep that at the front of my mind.
I love it. I like that. And final question. If we are speaking a year from now and we are popping champagne, what are we celebrating?
Hopefully, related to what we've talked about today, that we're celebrating additional groundbreakings of sustainable aviation production facilities in Washington State.
Fantastic. I wish you all the best for that, Andy. Congratulations on getting this bill through, making Washington State so attractive for sustainable aviation fuel producers, making it so attractive for airlines who want to uplift SAF, for example. And I think there's a lot that we can all learn when it comes to taking your time to get things over the line. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website, green.simplifying.com, and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.